Okay, so yeah, I'm going to be talking mostly about a paper that Patrick and I, my advisor Patrick Hayden and I, put out on Archive a couple of months ago, which is called Approximate Quantum Error Correction Revisited, Introducing the Alphabet. And that's, you know, it's a pure quantum information paper. And then if I have time at the end, I'm going to talk a little bit about a paper which will come out when it comes out. It is not out yet. Called Learning the Alphabets of Black Holes, which is, you know, about how these quantum error correction ideas are realized in the context of quantum gravity and specifically ADS-CFT. Okay, so let's start with something very simple. Let's say Alice and Bob are in their separate labs and they want to create a Bell pair of entanglement between them. And let's say they have the ability to send exactly one qubit from Alice to Bob. Can they do this? Right? Yes, very easily, okay? Alice prepares a Bell pair in her own lab, and then she just sends one of the two qubits to Bob, and then they share a Bell pair. So we say that the ability to send one qubit is a strictly more powerful resource than having one shared Bell pair between you, which we will call one e-bit, okay? Why one e-bit rather than just one Bell pair? Well, one Bell pair doesn't have bit in the name, so yeah, we say e-bit instead. And yeah, so this inequality means that you can use the qubit to simulate the e-bit. If you have an e-bit, if you have a shared Bell pair, you can't use it to send a qubit, so it's a strict inequality, it doesn't go the other way around. And similarly, we could also use our one qubit to send one classical bit, or C bit. Okay, let's do something very slightly more fancy than that. Let's do ordinary quantum teleportation. Okay, so Alice and Bob share one E bit, one Bell pair, and they also send two C bits, two classical bits from Alice to Bob, and using that, they're able to send one qubit from Alice to Bob. Okay? So this is slightly, you know, this is now a highly non-trivial thing. It was an amazing result when it first happened, but it's still a strict inequality. With one qubit, you can create your E bit or you can send a C bit, but you can't both create an E bit and send two C bits. If you wanted to send two C bits, you would in fact instead need to do super dense coding. You need to have an extra bit of entanglement on this, the right hand side. Okay? So this is not a reversible protocol. It's not efficient. It's not an equality. What I'm going to be talking about today, sort of the most surprising result, is that if we replace those classical bits with something new that I'm going to eventually define called zero bits, then not only is the inequality still true this way, it's now also true in this direction. And so this is actually an equal sign. And the only subtlety here is that there's a little a on top of here. So what that means is that actually, it's not one e-bit plus two zero bits equals one qubit. It's infinity e-bits plus two infinity zero bits equals infinity qubits. And this is very important because two zero bits doesn't really exist in a precisely defined sense. We're only going to be able to define them in the limit of like infinitely many copies, effectively. Okay. And there's something more we can say about this. In fact, let's say we have A e-bit and B zero bits, okay? And let's say that we were able to use, use new chalk, use them to create A prime e-bits and B prime zero bits. Turns out that this is possible if and only if A is greater than or equal to A prime and B is greater than or equal to B prime. Okay? So these are independent resources that cannot be interconverted between each other. The partial ordering on them from simulation is just the product partial ordering on the A and B. So you can think of E-bits are the resource of correlation, the resource of shared entanglement between them. You can think of zero bits as the fundamental resource of like transmission. It allows you to send something for Alice to Bob, but on its own, it doesn't really allow you to send anything. It's like it's an empty shipping container going from Alice to Bob. If you have other stuff, you can then use it to send stuff, but on its own, sends effectively nothing. Okay, so my aim in this talk is to get to the point where you guys understand what this means, and at a very schematic level why it's true. The actual proof is sort of annoying, it has a lot of epsilons in there. And also understand the larger framework that it comes out of. And then if time allows, then I want to say some stuff about black holes and ADS-CFT and cool speculative stuff like that. Okay, so the most important thing to understanding what this means is to explain to you guys what a zero bit is, okay? Zero bit is very, very simple. It's the special case of an alpha bit when alpha equals zero. Unfortunately, explaining what an alpha bit is going to be slightly more work. So Patrick was apparently trying to explain this to John Preskill a few weeks ago or something, and he was apparently trying to explain it for quite a while, and there was quite a lot of confusion for quite a while. And I'm definitely not Patrick Hayden, and I don't know how many of you are John Preskill in disguise, but basically, I'm going to do my best. It may be slightly confusing, but I will try to make it as simple as possible. So we're going to put definition of alphabets up here, and we're just going to work towards this. We're going to start with some things that are definitely not the definition of the alphabet, and then we're eventually going to get there. Okay. Let's say, what do we know about alphabets? Well, I've told you alpha equals zero, called zero bits. And I'll tell you another thing, that alpha goes anywhere between zero or one, okay? And in fact, alpha equals one is another interesting special case. This one may be a bit more familiar to you. It's actually called a qubit. Okay. So, let's now start trying to define it. Okay, let's say Alice, call A, has some state psi that is in some qubit, qdit even, c to the d, for some d. And say she sends it through some channel N to Bob. Okay? When can we say she's successfully sent the qdit to Bob? Obviously, it's not for any channel if this is just completely depolarizing, all Bob has got is a load of noise. Okay? More generally, you might say if N is the identity channel, Bob obviously has received the qdit, but actually, it's slightly more generally than that, right? Because, you know, say the channel just permutes the computational basis, then Bob still has received the qdit, he just knows he has to do a bit of manipulation first. So generally, if there exists any channel D, decoding channel, that can decode the qdit, then the qdit has been sent. Okay? This is sort of the essence of quantum error correction. Okay. What about if we want to make this slightly weaker, okay? If we want to make it easier for Bob to decode the qubit. Well, potentially he could know something about the state psi. What is there to know? He could know that it lies in some subspace S of A, okay? And in that case, then he doesn't need to be able to decode the whole of A. He just needs there to exist a D that depends on this subspace S such that he can decode N in order to to recover the state so long as it was in S. And is this easier than it was before? Yes, absolutely. This is how quantum error correction works, right? Alice has some, encodes it into some particularly nice subspace, and then even if the channel is in general noisy and doesn't like completely preserve state in general, then for that subspace, it's well behaved, Bob can still recover what it was, fine. We're not interested in that, because that relies on Alice knowing what the subspace S is, or at least S being a particular like nice subspace. We're interested what happens if he has to be able to do this for all subspaces S, some dimension, which for the moment we're going to call K. Okay? So, hypothetically, Bob knows it's in some subspace, but Alice doesn't know which subspace Bob knows it in. It's in. Okay? Or more generally, in fact, and where the power of this is going to come, this state over here, psi, could be entangled with some system that Bob owns. Okay, Bob controls. And depending on the state of the system Bob controls, the subspace S could be different. That's where the power is going to come that's going to allow us to do these things and make these inequalities into equal signs, basically. Okay.
Sorry, the input has to be on S.
The input state has to be, the output is just whatever the output of whatever the image of S in N is. It could be some random thing, but Bob has to just be able to decode it and get the original state
DS,
back.
DS doesn't necessarily act on S, it could act on whatever.
DS will take states on like B or whatever we want to call that and put output states on S.
It depends on S, but it does not act.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, sorry, my notation is unconventional. Okay, so what about this case? Is this easier for Bob than just doing a general D? Okay? The answer actually is no. If Bob can do this for literally any subspace S, then he can just do an ordinary D that works for everything. Okay? So all this stuff I've just said, all these extra details haven't helped at all. So why did I bother saying that? Okay? The answer is up until now, we've been assuming this is exact. And if it's not exact, if it's only approximate, then everything I just said in the last two sentences was untrue. So let's make, instead of this being an equal sign, let's put a norm here. It's going to be the diamond norm. Don't worry about the details of that. In this case, any norm will be kind of equivalent up to some stuff. We're going to make it then very close in terms of this metric. Okay? So it's roughly the identity, but not quite. And now we're going to ask the same question. And to answer that question, I'm going to take this n, and I'm just going to take a Steinspring dilation, okay? I'm going to make it into a isometry V, I'll call it V of n, and that gives an output to Bob, and it also just gives an output to the environment that's thrown away, okay? And for convenience, I'm going to treat this as canonically identifying A with a subspace of B cross E. Just, it makes the notation easier. Okay. Quantum node cloning's theorem says if Bob's able to get the state, E, the environment, must not be able to get the state. Can make that much more rigorous and approximate. I'm not going to do the proof. You know, it's basically an application of the information disturbance theorem, if you know that one. But it turns out that this thing being less than delta is equivalent to, for all, put an equivalence sign, for all rho that are going to be in AR, state rho, okay, R is just going to be a reference system. The state rho, when you throw away the stuff B gets, when you just have what the environment and reference know, is going to be almost exactly the same as sigma E cross rho just on R. This is a trace norm, and this is going to be some epsilon, okay? And sigma here is just some fixed sigma in that's just a state in A. You can take it to be the maximally mixed state if you want. It doesn't really matter. And you'll notice that's not a delta. It's now an epsilon. That's because there's not an exact relationship between what the delta is and what the epsilon is. But R is a reference system. And there's one very important thing I haven't said yet, which is where this K comes in. Okay? This K, the dimension of the subspace you're decoding, is equal to the dimension of the references you have to consider. So you have to consider references of dimension K. And we have that this 1/8 delta squared is less than or equal to epsilon is less than or equal to 4 square root delta. Okay? Don't worry about the details of that. The point is, if epsilon's very small, you know delta is pretty damn small, and vice versa. Okay? And it's a simple relationship. There's no factors of the dimension or anything that show up there.
And there's no quantification over S in this.
Sorry?
There's no quantification over S.
No, this is, yeah. This is having to be true for all S's. And the only way at the dimension of S shows up is that there's a K here and the same K shows up here. Otherwise, there's no Ks or Ds that show up in the bounds. Okay. So, the point here, and the reason that the dimension of S now matters, is that this dimension of R is also equal to K. Okay? And it turns out that if we bound this epsilon for, say, a small reference system dimension K, then it does not necessarily bound. The tightest bound we can put on this thing for a larger reference system is actually one that grows linearly with the dimension K of the reference system. Okay? So say if we replaced dimension of RK with 2K, then potentially this epsilon can also grow by a factor of 2. Now, K goes between 1 and D. So if D is small, there's a limit to how much difference this can make. It's a factor of D from like the smallest thing to the largest thing it can be. But if we take like D to get really, really large, then you can have epsilon be very small for small dimensions S, but still be very large for like S being the whole space. Okay? So this explains two things. Firstly, it explains why, if we just did exact error correction, it's all completely equivalent. There's absolutely no zeros. Because if epsilon is zero, then if you multiply zero by anything, it's still zero. Okay? But if we allow some approximateness, some little noise epsilon, then it can actually grow very quickly. It can grow linearly with the dimension of the subspaces we're trying to decode. Okay. Yep.
I think it's okay to be confused.
Yeah, it is. Okay. So we have two equivalent definitions, okay, of what it means to be able to. One is that we can decode. Bob is going to be able to decode the state so long as he already knows what it is, okay? I like to play in the first Pirates of the Caribbean film. There's the Isla de Muerta, is an island that cannot be found except by those who already know where it is. Okay? In this case, it's a quantum state that you cannot be found except by those who already know what the state is, roughly. Already know some smaller subspace of states it's in. But it doesn't matter what subspace they know it's in. As long as they know some subspace it's in, that's enough to work it out.
So the information I want to send is K dimension?
You have two dimensions. We have the larger dimension D, okay? That's the dimension of the space that Qdit Alice is sending, okay? But she knows Bob already knows something else about it, okay? She knows Bob already knows some k-dimensional subspace it's in, okay? She doesn't know what k-dimensional subspace Bob thinks it's in, but she knows that much. As I say, this is the point where it gets a bit confusing unless you spend quite a long time thinking about it. I'm going to try and, when I finish making the definition of this, I'm going to do a sort of more practical example of what it means. which should hopefully clear things up somewhat. But think of it, for example, Oh, if you're a high energy person, if you've ever read Patrick Hayden and John Preskill's paper on black holes as mirrors, they imagine some large black hole that's doing complicated stuff inside, and then they imagine throwing a small, like, unknown state into that black hole. And so now the black hole is in some subspace of possible states. You don't know what subspace, it could be some arbitrarily complicated subspace, but it's some small subspace. And you then think about what, how that helps you decode the state and whether that means you can decode the state more easily. Let me get to the end of what the actual definition of an alphabet is, and then I will, take some more questions and try and make things a bit clearer. Okay. So, because this K can vary between 1 and D, okay, then we can have epsilon, or equivalently delta, vary quite a lot as we change A, K, okay? But when we want to talk about, like, you know, actually having asymptotic inequalities and stuff, we want to imagine at some point that the limit of this epsilon is going to go to 0, okay? And so if D is constant, then epsilon can only vary by a factor of D. And then if I take the limit of epsilon going to 0, then it's going to go to 0 for all sizes of subspace at the same time. It'll be slightly larger for the bigger ones, smaller for the smaller ones. But at the end of the day, they're all going to be equivalent. So what we need to, if this is going to be interesting and, like, actually have different inequivalent resources in some sort of exact limit, we not only need to think about epsilon tending to 0, but we also need to think about D getting larger at the same time, okay? And we need to think about basically the system getting infinitely big at the same time that the errors tend to 0. And this is the usual thing you have with, like, quantum capacities, right? You can only do it in the asymptotic limit of sending lots and lots of copies. Error gets smaller and smaller. The more copies you send, larger the state you're putting through. Okay. But still, we've got to think about what happens to this K. Okay? And this is a slightly subtle thing. Let's say we kept K constant, well, D tends to infinity. Then it doesn't really matter what K is. Okay? Because we don't care about constant factors in front of this epsilon, and it's only going to make a constant factor difference. Similarly, let's say we had the dimension be some constant times D. Okay? Again, doesn't make a difference as we take the error going to 0. The sort of interesting phenomenon happens when the dimension of the subspaces we allow to grow with D, but not as quickly as D, sublinearly with D. And in fact, we're going to consider them growing as D to the alpha for some alpha between 0 and 1. And I'm going to put D to the alpha here as well. And this, if we can decode any subspace of dimension less than d to the alpha, we say that we have sent Bob an alpha dit. Okay? And we're going to take d to infinity, so quantifying it in terms of alpha dits is kind of stupid. So we're just going to say that this is also equal to, by convention, log d alpha. Okay. So, right, I will try to deal with as much confusion on points now if you have clear questions. Otherwise, I can start doing the closest thing to a sort of canonical example of what alphabets physically are that we have.
So, is the alpha equals 0 case actually alpha strictly 0, or?
So the alpha equals 0 case is alpha strictly 0. Obviously, decoding a one-dimensional subspace doesn't really make sense. So what we're going to do, this is a great question, and I meant to add that in, but I also didn't want to confuse you guys too quickly. Just going to add a plus 1 there and a plus 1 here in our definition. Okay, that makes absolutely like no physical difference because we don't care about like constant factors. So I could have put a factor of 2 at the front, I could have done anything. All I wanted was to make the alpha equals 0 case be like strictly greater than 1 rather than equal to 1.
So the alpha equals 0 case, you just say...
Alpha equals 0 case, think all two-dimensional subspaces. Exactly right. Yep. But it could equally be all 10-dimensional subspaces, all 100-dimensional subspaces. It doesn't matter in the limit we're taking. Yep.
So in the end, an alpha bit for alpha large or small?
Yep.
Is a channel? What is it?
It's a quantum resource. You can think of it as like a channel. It's the ability of Alice to send something to Bob. That's not enough information to decode the whole state, but is enough if Bob already has some information.
So is a 0 bit just a bit or a qubit that's perfect in the asymptotic limit?
Alpha equals 1 is just a qubit. Alpha equals 0 is the weakest of all. It's the ability to, if you already know it's in some two-dimensional subspace, you know it's just in like one of two spaces. Yeah, it's the ability to decode any two-dimensional subspace of a large d-dimensional space.
Sorry, but again, it's basically a channel. It's n.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So in this sense, like classical bit is a completely dephasic channel.
Yeah, exactly. It's the equivalent of that, but I'm going to give you the closest we have to a canonical channel for it. But really, it's defined in this very abstract way. It is annoyingly abstract. It is, yeah. If anyone, we've been trying actually recently to come up with an equivalent definition that doesn't just work in the asymptotic limit. We don't have one, and actually we think there doesn't exist one. If we had a less abstract one, I would definitely be using that, and not this. I apologize. Okay, I'll just shove this up here. Let's do a sort of physical example. Imagine I'm smashing a lot of chalk. Alice has some large number n qubits, okay? And she's going to put them in a big box, going to do some unitary U, okay? Treat this for the moment as just a completely random, like how random, in fact, random element of 2 design is enough if you care about that, but treat it as just a random unitary that Bob knows, okay? They have some shared randomness. Alice does something completely random to it. She then takes a load of these qubits, beta n of them, and sends them to Bob, and takes the remainder, 1 minus beta n, and just throws them away. Okay? Now, we want to try and work out when this thing will be small in the limit of large n, limit large numbers of qubits being thrown in here and having some really complicated random unitary done to them. Turns out, in that limit, let's put a reference system in here. And this is going to R. This is going to be alpha n qubits, okay? If you have n qubits, the dimension is 2 to the n, so d to the alpha is 2 to the alpha n. So we effectively have alpha n qubits in our reference system. Now we imagine putting in some state that's entangled between these two systems, and we want to know, this is R again, if when we restrict it to these two, it just looks like completely random noise, plus whatever you put into R, okay? Turns out, basically based on the power of like the randomness and the limit of large n, this will be true as long as the number of qubits in E and R is less than the number of qubits in B. Okay? So as long as alpha plus 1 minus beta strictly less than beta. Quick rearrangement, we need beta greater than 1 plus alpha over 2. Okay? Let's do the case alpha equals zero. What this is saying is that you can decode any two-dimensional subspace from B, okay, with a random unitary and then a large size, as long as B gets more than half of the qubits. Yep?
Sorry, I mean, so, so this is supposed to be for every state you put in.
Yep. So,
I mean, so why does it matter whether U is random or not? I mean, it seems to me you could just absorb that into a state and then say, well, it's just state density.
Because we want this to be true for every state. The randomness is basically converting, like, average state into average case into worst case.
Worst case into average case.
But
there is no average case in this definition. It's already.
It's the definition is worst case. Yes.
So I don't see what the random.
This needs to be true for all states. Okay. Let's say I put an unentangled state in there that's unentangled between these qubits and these qubits,
yeah.
And I didn't apply a random unitary. Okay. Then. Clearly, now take the two-dimensional subspace to just be like a state here and the same state, just a different state on the E part,
yeah.
Right? Clearly, Bob's not going to be able to tell the difference between those states.
That's right. But then what if you do have the U, but you do that state that you just said, would you dagger apply first? That's a valid input state.
Sure. Yeah. Alice can just do the U as an encoding, yes. But if we need both Bob and Alice to know the U, they need to know the randomness. Because Bob needs to be able to decode the randomness.
It's not just a single U. It's a
shared random U, yes.
Shared random U.
Actually, for zero bits, you can do it with a single U by taking a typical subspace. For alphabets, for like achieving the general alphabet capacity, we've only been able to do it with shared randomness. So it's you need a source of shared randomness.
Wait, sorry, this is the encoding?
The encoding.
This is not the channel.
I'm combining them together for simplicity, but yeah.
Okay. If you get to a single U, there's always some state that you can put in.
There will be if you yes.
On
yes.
E.
Yes.
And that's bad.
Yes. So that's why you need the ensemble if you're going to do it this way. Ignore the thing I said about zero bits. You can do it using measure concentration by taking some subspace as the input, but just don't worry about that. Yeah. You need an ensemble of U's, and they need to be known by both Alice and Bob. So if you're a high energy person, again, as I said, you can think of this as like taking a large black hole. Black hole does very complicated stuff, which we can sort of model as randomness. And then you allow it to evaporate into Hawking radiation. And Bob creates fraction beta of the Hawking radiation. Environment gets the rest. If the environment has less than half, the environment should just see a random noise. That's what the page curve says, okay? It says that the Hawking radiation is thermal until you have more than half of it. So that necessarily means that if you do have more than half of it, you can decode any two-dimensional space. That's black hole scenario is Hayden Preskill.
So in the context of Hayden Preskill, right now A system contains n qubits.
Yes. Yep.
So should I think of A and R as a rank for ranks and numbers?
It's often convenient to think about that way. We actually need to think about an arbitrary entangled state. If you look at this definition here, this is an arbitrary entangled state on AR. Yeah. And so in general, if say it's an unentangled state, R will have some memory, but its only memory will be of its own reduced density matrix. So there's a confusing thing here. Let's think again about the zero bits, okay? If any two states are distinguishable, that means two orthogonal states have to end up at least almost orthogonal, okay? And that means that the sort of sphere of two to the n dimensional sphere still has to end up as a 2 to the n dimensional sphere. But we've thrown away half the qubits, so our Hilbert space is only 2 to the n over 2 dimensional. How the hell can this happen, right? The answer is that we have a lot of... this state is actually a very noisy state. It's a density matrix. And if the Hilbert space is 2 to the n over 2 dimensional, then the space of density matrices is 2 to the n dimensional. And so it does actually work out. There is space in the states of half the number of qubits to preserve all of the sphere, preserve the geometry of the sphere of all the pure states that can be given as inputs. Okay.
I said earlier they become entangled. What's doing that?
Okay, so E is a thing we've added to like purify the channel, basically. It's the stuff that's been thrown away rather than sent to Bob.
Right.
R is a reference system that we're including because it turns out that to have this thing be true, you just need to include an extra system R. So R is just going through as the identity, okay? And it's just the way it works in terms of like channel norms.
Rho ER could just be a tensor product of rho E with rho R or something.
It can be, yeah. So
that's what I'm confused about. I mean,
so this rho is in AR, okay?
Okay.
It can be any state. It can be a tensor product. It can be an entangled state, okay? But what it's saying is that when you throw away the B stuff, then you just end up with approximately a tensor product. And it's a tensor product between something on E that doesn't depend on the input state at all, and just the rho R, which is just the reduced density matrix
to R. Close to that, right?
Yeah, very close to that and the trace norm.
So you're allowing for some possibility that E and R will get mixed up a little bit with each other.
E and R...
because you said that's exactly zero, nothing interesting happens.
Yeah, so, yeah, there can still be a tiny bit of entanglement between these two things, yes. But very little.
That has to happen after it goes through that U.
That will be coming from, at the beginning here, we'll have had to put in an entangled state for that to be true.
Between R and...
between R and this thing, which is A, I should have put...
Okay,
and then E comes from
that,
A.
How does it happen?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
so
yeah.
So
we have to consider entangled states as inputs. Yeah. Okay. So let's say you believe me that this inequality is true. Okay. What does this tell us? Well, Alice sent beta n qubits to Bob. Okay. So. She sent beta, let's take it to be equal to 1 plus alpha over 2, be as efficient as possible. So using 1 plus alpha over 2 n qubits, Alice has sent this entire state here as an alpha bit. So she has sent n alpha bits. But she can actually do a bit better than that, okay? Because this thing we said she just threw away. But there's no reason she had to throw it away, okay? She just did this nice encoding with a random channel. She still has this whole state. She only has space to send these to Bob, but these she can just keep, okay? And these, we said, will be in a maximally mixed state. But it's in a maximally mixed state that is purified by stuff Bob has, okay? So actually, we also have 1 minus beta n e bits have been created by this process. So that is actually plus 1 minus alpha over 2 n e bit. Now, taking the limit of n to infinity, so I'll put a little a on top of here. Well, for convenience, I'm going to say n equals 2. Get a 1 plus alpha here, 1 here, and a 1 minus alpha, sorry, a 2 here. Yep, there we go. Let me just check that's actually right. Yep.
There's a quote here, these qubits and alpha bits are between Alice and Bob, but the e bits are now between Bob and E.
No. So before I was assuming she just threw away those e bits, okay? Those qubits, the 1 minus b to n. But there was no reason for them to do that. So instead of throwing them away to the environment, she's just going to keep them in some state a prime. So Alice holds these, Bob holds this stuff. Alice and Bob now share entanglement.
Alice, you take this fully quantum reverse Shannon thing.
Yeah, so it's similar.
But, I mean, this is assuming that she controls the channel.
Sorry?
This is assuming that she controls the channel.
Yeah, I mean, I'm assuming we have a noiseless channel here to send beta n qubits. 3.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
so that's...
Shannon's capacity is context, there's some
yeah.
channel.
Yeah. This is... So, yeah, exactly. I'm sticking to a completely noiseless framework here for simplicity. You know, we proved in the paper the capacity, alphabet capacity for general channels. It's kind of messy unless the entanglement assisted capacity is exactly what you'd think of just like 2 over 1 plus alpha times the mutual information. It's just it's the obvious thing. But the actual general capacity is slightly messy. But this thing ends up being more elegant, so it's the one I'm going to do.
So, I'm still confused. So, in this particular example, what's the number of zero bits?
The number of zero bits is n, okay?
The number of zero bits
is the number, because that's the state Bob is going to eventually be able to decode, and it's the state on n qubits, so it's n zero bits, or generally n alpha bits.
You're saying n zero bits and n alpha bits.
So, alphabets, okay, let's ignore zero bits, we'll just do the general alphabet case, okay? We have beta equals 1 plus alpha over 2, okay. The channel we're using is, Alice does her encoding, she then takes these beta n qubits and sends them to Bob, okay? So the resource we've used is 1 plus alpha qubits. Beta n for n equals 2, and beta equals what I said. Okay, it's really, there's an infinity factor I'm dropping. And what we've been able to achieve with it is we've both sent this whole state as an alphabet, so we've sent n alphabets, and we've also created this much entanglement. Yeah, because this is going to be a maximally mixed state, it can be kept by Alice, and it's purified by stuff that Bob has. So we've created a load of entanglement.
Between
Alice and Bob. Originally, the state is entirely held by Alice. Now Bob's ending up with all this stuff, Alice has this stuff, they're entangled, we've created entanglement.
So you hear me, A prime?
Yeah. I called it A prime to show that Alice still controls that state.
A prime on R.
Okay.
If
at this point, ignore R. We used R to prove it works for it actually sent the alphabets, but just think of an input state here. She sends it through. It ends up with something that's complicated and entangled between this stuff and this stuff. This stuff is kept by Alice. This stuff goes to Bob. Cool. Okay. The sort of magical thing. This is cool. What's much cooler to me is the fact that there's an equal sign, greater than equal sign going the other way. Okay? And that, I'm gonna prove it to you. I'm gonna do it in 2 steps. First step, I'm gonna show that 1 alphabet plus 1 e-bit is greater than or equal to 1 plus alpha something new called a cobit. Some of you may have heard of, some of you may not. And then something that's known for a long time, 2 cobits equals 1 qubit plus 1 e-bit. And if you apply that, substitute in, rearrange, you'll get that thing with the inequality going the other way. And that's going to make that an equal sign. A cobit, I'm going to define in a minute. Something Aram Harrow invented, what, 12 years ago now? Someone who has been in this field a lot longer than me could probably tell you. I will define it in pretty much right now. Okay? So if you have a qubit and an e-bit, we can do super dense coding. Okay? We can send 2 classical bits. What Aram Harrow realized is we can actually do something better than that. Okay? So you can think of a classical bit as taking 0a to 0b and some depolarizing. Some a 0 is also held by environment. And similarly for 1. Okay. A cobit is the following. Rather than have that be held by the environment, have it be purified by Alice. Have Alice keep the copy. Okay? What we've effectively done is taken this sort of noisy classical channel that destroys the superposition and instead purified it, but purified it on the combined system of Alice and Bob. If you then do that, turns out you get an extra. Basically, you can still do it, and it turns out that's an equal sign. You can do it the other way as well. If you do teleportation using cobits, you get an extra 2 e-bits at the end. Don't worry about that. Okay. How are we going to use? So the new thing is this inequality. How are we going to do that? Okay. Let's say Alice has a state and has a basis, computational basis, we're going to label by m and n, okay? M is going to go between 0 and d to the alpha. So m is going to go between 0 and d. N is going to go between 0 and d to the alpha. This is going to be our 1 plus alpha codits in this case, okay? So the M is basically, that's a d-dimensional space times a d to the alpha, that's a d to the 1 plus alpha. Okay, and Alice wants to send this state to Bob. Okay, so they also share an edit. So we have k equals 1 to d, k Alice, k Bob, and I'm not going to bother normalizing it. So they share that edit. And we want Alice to do something clever so that she can use that edit together with an alpha dit to send all these codits to Bob. Basically going to be a variation on super dense coding. Okay? What we're going to do, we'll define UMN. It's going to be something Alice can do on her own. Okay? And it's just going to take that state, and it's going to take it to e to the 2 pi I m k over d k plus n k. Done nothing to Bob's system, just manipulated Alice's. Okay? Now, Alice can apply this unitary depending on this state here. Okay, she can basically apply u, it's just a sum over mn, projector on the cobit system, okay, she applies umn depending on what state she has there. Now, These states are all orthogonal for all m and n. But the clever thing about this is, say Alice now sends this to Bob as an alpha dit, okay? Bob has this system here, and conditional on knowing that this state is in K, the only states that this thing can be in are K, K plus 1, K plus 2, so on, up to the range that n can go over, which is K plus d to the alpha. So Bob, conditioning on the state of this thing, knows a d to the alpha dimensional subspace that this state lies in. That's exactly the definition of an alpha dit, because he is then able to decode that. You need to do some more work to show it all works in superposition, deal with the epsilons, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not going to do that. So Bob is then able to encode this entire state. When he has this entire state, every m and n, this is orthogonal. So he now has a copy of this state over here. He's received 1 plus alpha codits. Yep.
So I'm pretty confused about the role of the encoding here.
Yep.
So these definitions that you gave didn't actually have any encoding at all. But could I imagine inserting that? I mean,
I generally were just absorbing the encoding into the definition of n. You should think about...
So if you do that, it doesn't permit Bob to know which unitary you're picking, right?
I've skipped the step of how you set up the shared randomness at the beginning, and then you can just repeatedly reuse that shared randomness. That's how in practice we need to do this. I've skipped that because I didn't want to overcomplicate. It's complicated enough already, and I didn't want to like make it more sick.
Well, okay, I mean, but the normal distinction between Alice's encoding and the channel is you can't control the channel, you can control the encoding.
Yeah.
Which includes using shared randomness to pick.
Yeah, okay. Encoding. Okay. So, treat.
But it's actually much more than that, which is. Maybe this is something else you showed in your paper but haven't mentioned, but. The way this definition is set up, different n's are kind of different kinds of alpha bits. And
yeah.
This notion of, I mean,
yeah.
The encoding that you're using here is totally different from the encoding
yeah.
you had before.
Yeah. This is where you end up getting deep into the weeds of like rigorously defining what it means for asymptotic equalities involving alphabets, which we do in the paper and you can read it. Because you need to end up needing multiple epsilons. It's really messy and annoying because you know, if you have an exact alpha dit, then you have a q dit automatically, right? So you've got to include an epsilon in there and then take the limit d to infinity, and then you can take the limit epsilon going to zero. The best definition I can give for an alpha bit is the limit as d to goes to infinity of 1 over log d alpha dit. I will grant you that is unsatisfying.
Sorry, are you saying that it actually doesn't depend somehow on the channel or the encoding?
I don't want to think about an alphabet as being tied to a specific channel. If a channel gives you a capacity, a channel has a capacity to send alphabets if there's an encoding that then lets you send alphabets to it. And alphabets, I'm just thinking of an abstract thing of allowing Bob to do the stuff Bob's going to do.
But I guess I don't understand what these equalities or inequalities would mean if, I mean, so in particular, I don't understand what the equality would mean if you prove one inequality using one channel and one encoding, and the other direction of the inequality using a different channel and a different encoding.
Oh, yeah. So, absolutely. So, when I just used the noiseless channel to prove this direction, that is completely cheating. Absolutely. But in the paper, we do the construction for a general quantum channel, and we show that for a general quantum channel that allows you to do alphabets, it allows you to have this equality in this direction.
Same thing is different.
What do you mean on both sides? Yeah.
In both directions.
Yeah.
But the encoding that you use is different.
But it doesn't matter what channel we use. We prove that Any channel that you can use to send alphabets, you can send in this direction, and then, like, in a sort of channel independent way is, I guess, what I'm trying to say.
Okay.
Yeah. It doesn't depend on the details. There's no taking advantage of the specifics of the channel.
But in that case, you do have to have, say, there exists an encoding for this channel.
Yeah.
There exists an encoding that has that.
Yeah. But you can sort of black box a lot of stuff. You can, like, treat the channel and the decodings as black box and just assume that they exist and then prove that you can do everything you want to do. And then using another encoding and then, right? Yeah.
What I'm getting at is a kind of consistency,
I think your problem is with some step that I've been skipping because, you know, there's just not time to cover a 60-page paper. I can, yeah, maybe talk to you afterwards and try and, like, work out exactly what the issue is. Okay. So, we do that, we get this step, move it across, and we end up with this equality. And finally, if we put alpha equals 0 into here, that goes away. We end up with 1 qubit is equal to 2 0 bits plus 1 e-bit, which is the claim I made at the beginning. I will definitely, I'm very happy to discuss subtleties afterwards. I would like to talk very briefly about some quantum gravity stuff before I go to questions. Let's rub this stuff out. Okay. So, how do these show up in black holes? I sort of briefly mentioned earlier that sort of zero bits had already shown up in black holes because they were what Hayden and Preska were talking about in the Black Holes as Mirrors paper 10 years ago, which is sort of what launched the quantum information and quantum gravity field. So one very simple story you can give is, okay, they were studying how much of the Hawking radiation you need to have zero bits. Is there a natural interpretation for how much you need to have the alphabet? And basically the argument I gave with the random channel, or you can make slightly different arguments about like Hawking radiation, argues that if you have 1 plus alpha over 2 fraction of the Hawking radiation, that will necessarily encode the alphabet to the black hole. Okay? What does this mean physically? Imagine doing what Hayden and Preskill did, and you have a black hole, and then you have a diary that you drop into it. But rather than this being now a small quantum state of fixed dimension as you take the classical limit, this is now itself a black hole, okay? And it's a black hole of area alpha A. This is in an unknown state. The rest of the black hole is in a known state. You drop it in, it ends up, final black hole ends up having area A. It's then in some unknown state of dimension approximately e to the alpha s, where s is the entropy of the black hole.
What is A?
This is the final black hole horizon after they've merged together.
So A is
the area of the horizon. Of the whole system, yeah. Right, so our final black hole, the dimension of it is sort of e to the A over 4g Newton. But we actually know it was originally in that state. So we originally know it's in subspace like that with an extra alpha in there. Okay? So the question of when you know the state of this black hole is exactly when you know the alphabets of the larger black hole. And that happens, we know, after you have 1 plus alpha over 2 fraction of the Hawking radiation. And the interesting thing about this is the capacity, if we go back to this equality over here, the capacity of a noiseless quantum channel to send alpha bits is actually 2 over 1 plus alpha. So the Hawking radiation is actually spitting out the black holes, the alpha bits of the black hole, as fast as it possibly can, which is the opposite of what we usually think of black holes, right? We think of black holes as holding information in for as long as possible. But in this case, they actually put it out as quickly as possible. But this is actually exactly the same thing, right? If we go back to the thing over here, the very fact that they keep the Hawking radiation for small fractions of smack fractions is as forgetful as possible, looks as much like thermal noise as possible, necessarily means that the opposite fraction, 1 minus that, encodes as large, as good alpha bits as possible, as higher value of alpha bits as possible. The terrible pun we made for this is black holes are alphabet soup, where soup is spelled S-U-P. Anyway. slightly more sophisticated thing can say about alpha bits and black holes sort of has more interesting consequences is if we go to ADS-CFT. And I don't know, again, how many of you are familiar with error correction in ADS-CFT, but the basic idea is you have ADS space, looks like, going to draw it as the hyperbolic disk, 2 plus 1 dimensions, and you have a quantum field theory on the boundary. And we split the boundary, I'll do this, into two regions, region A and region A bar, okay? And the boundary of this boundary is here, and you take the minimal surface, in this case a geodesic, connecting the boundary of the boundary, okay? And then you say that this splits the interior, the bulk, which is described by quantum gravity, to two regions, little a bar, okay? And then the theory is that you can decode little a, the state on little a, just using the state on big A. Or equivalently, for every operator on little a, there is an operator on big A that will do the same job for this like subclass of states that have smooth geometry. Okay, so how was this proved? Well, paper that originally sort of argued slash proved this is Harley Dong Wall, and what they say is they use a result that if two states look the same on little a bar, then they look the same on big A bar. And they said, if that's exactly true, then you can prove, basically using the equivalent of what we just did here, you know, things looking the same on the E means they're distinguishable on B, vice versa. Things looking the same on big A bar means they're distinguishable on big A, okay? And so they argued that that must mean you can use operators on big A to decode little a. But there's one subtlety here, which is that the results they were using are only expected to be true approximately. And they made an assumption that they were true exactly. And if we look here, when we go to the approximate case, you need to include this reference system here. Okay? Now for this setup I've just drawn, this is sort of unproblematic. But the situation gets a lot more complicated if I plop black hole in the middle here, okay? In this case, there's some geodesic that we'll call A1 going around this side. We'll also get a geodesic with A2 going the other side, and the black hole has area A. Okay. Black hole is outside of little a bar. So you might think you can decode the state of the black hole on, I really shouldn't have used A for that. I'll call this A0. On big A. But, okay, the definition of the entanglement wedge has two terms. Has it's the surface that minimizes the area with a 4G plus S bulk, where this should be thought of as the entanglement in the bulk space. And normally when we take G Newton to zero, this is just gonna get swamped, okay? This is order one over G Newton, this is order one, you can just ignore it. But if you have a black hole sitting here, then the entropy of the black hole also has a 1 over G Newton sitting there. And that makes things far more problematic. So, when we consider this reference system that we need to do to have our result be true, if we want to include a large number of black hole microstates in our code space, then we equally have to consider a large, large reference system. And then we can imagine sticking some bulk entanglement going between here and here. And then we need to think about the entanglement wedge of not just A bar, but A bar with R, okay? And then surface A1 also has to cut through all this bulk entanglement, whereas surface A2 doesn't. Let's say A2 minus A1 over A0 strictly less than 1 and is equal to some random Greek letter that we'll call for convenience alpha, random choice out of 20 something. Now let's say that we want to decode a subspace of subspaces of dimension e to the alpha A over 4G. Okay? Call it alpha prime. If alpha prime is bigger than alpha, this plus this A1 is bigger than A2. Suddenly the entanglement wedge pops from being that side over to being the other side, and you can no longer, it's no longer going to be forgetful on A bar and R. Entanglement gets, this is no longer smaller than some tiny little epsilon, and you can no longer decode. So, conversely, by our nice duality between the delta and the epsilon, that means we can only decode black hole states on A of dimension less than or equal to E to the A over 4G. And yeah, I feel I should give you guys some time to ask some questions. So I'm going to stop very quickly, but I'm just going to say two final interesting consequences of this that sort of say something fundamental about ADS-CFT. The first is that this was only possible, alphabets only exist because we have non-zero epsilon, okay? If everything was exact, it would just all be nonsense. We could, you know, it's either qubits or nothing. So that tells us that error correction in ADS-CFT working the way it's expected to is only possible because it's approximate at finite G Newton. And more than that, because we have this bound of epsilon only growing most linearly with the dimension k, this allows us to put lower bounds on the size of the error that exists in ADS-CFT at finite G Newton. And in fact, they'll, you know, in this case, they will, the error for a single pure state on A bar must look like sort of e to the minus alpha s at most. The smallest possible error, we have epsilon greater than that. And the final thing I want to say is, what about if we think of this from the more usual way in ADS-CFT, rather than error correcting states, we think about being able to have operators on A that do the same thing as an operator on little a, okay? In this case, we would then have an operator on big A that does the same thing as the operator on little a, provided you restrict to a subspace of at most this dimension, okay? So the operator on big A depends on the state in little a. This is sort of state-dependent operators showing up in quantum gravity, and in fact, this A2 is the causal horizon of A. So it's actually state-dependent operators showing up behind a causal horizon. If you've read any of the sort of black holes literature in recent years, then there's been a lot of work done on, like, by Raju and Papademos on the idea that behind the horizon of the black hole, you need to have state dependence, that quantum mechanics only works behind black hole given state dependence. There's been a lot of talk about whether this breaks quantum mechanics, whether we need to, like, go to something beyond quantum mechanics, et cetera, et cetera. In this case, I don't think this is the exact same case. I don't think they're directly comparable. We have state dependence of operators behind the horizon. It's from completely ordinary quantum mechanics, and it's just a function of the way quantum error correction works in these circumstances. Any questions? Yep.
So going back to the values of alpha that are allowed for alpha bits.
Yep.
Just trying to understand. So a zero bit is a communication resource, obviously, which is weaker than a classical bit, which is weaker than a.
So yep.
Is there any way to, like, characterize the communication resource for each alpha? Or is there, like, a critical value of alpha to which it's less than C bit? Or is there any way to talk about qubit, C bit, and zero?
Yeah,
so, same setting.
Okay, so there's two things there. One is that. Yeah, there's two very good questions there. The first thing is just thinking about sort of a general alphabet in terms of other alphabets and so on. Any zero bit, alphabet, qubit, cobit, or ebit, okay, that space of like five different general resources is actually a two-dimensional space asymptotically, which I would argue the natural basis is zero bits and e-bits, because they're the ones that give you this nice product ordering, okay? But you can write any of those five in terms of any two. That's always true. In, you know, an alphabet, I have this equality here. Also, an alphabet is, I think, 1 plus alpha, zero bits, plus alpha, e-bits. That's another way of rewriting the sort of same fundamental fact. It's sort of very simple. When you include classical bits, it gets more complicated. Classical bit is not equal to any combination of those things. You can show that. One very speculative thing that we do in the paper, in a sort of discussion section, is, let's say, a classical bit, hang on. One classical bit is a more powerful resource than one zero bit. Okay? Similarly, one qubit is a more powerful resource than one classical bit. Let's say we just formally define what we called one y bit to be a qubit minus one c bit, and one x bit to be one c bit minus one zero bit. The sort of surprising thing. So if you do that and then write everything in terms of y bits, x bits, and zero bits, you again get a product ordering. Okay, you again that you cannot use y bits to simulate x bits to simulate zero bits. They're all completely independent resources. And they all have natural interpretations. So it said zero bit was the resource of like communication, of transmission. Okay? An x bit. Well, an X bit is the extra thing you have with a C bit that you don't have with a zero bit. Okay? And you also have, I'll just write this for convenience, one E bit, one Y bit, plus one X bit. So you can think of the X bit as a sort of resource of correlation. In fact, at one point we thought it was possible it might be a classical random bit. It isn't. But it's some sort of resource it's a classical resource that allows you to actually create correlation. And then the Y bit is sort of the resource of coherence, okay? It's the thing that an E bit has, but a classical bit doesn't. And yeah, there's not that much to say about this. It's sort of very elegant, but we have absolutely no idea what the sort of operational definitions of either of those things are. I expect they don't exist. It would be super cool if they did. If you had asked me a year ago, you know, we started this project with absolutely no intent to work out what one qubit minus one e-bit was. And I think if we'd said we were doing that, we would have been laughed at. And I think we would have thought it would be stupid and impossible and just wouldn't be well defined. But it turned out it was. So yeah, if someone can work out what these things are, then they can get to give them a better name than x bits and y bits. But for the moment, that's all we have. Yeah. Yep.
So, since you mentioned Hayden rescue,
yep.
Experiment, but what you described is not really Hayden rescue, it's Page's experiment, right? Because Hayden rescue has this n number of parts and then you throw information into the black hole. So I think, I think that you're thinking about this, Alice previews some state, let's say k, well, small subspace and encode it into a bigger message and then send it to a black hole and then we can discuss the Hayden rescue problem.
So,
It's
possible that the case for non-entangled black hole had been done before Hayden Preskill. I don't think, I mean, Page had obviously worked out the Page curve. I don't think he'd like realized that that meant when you had more than half, you could distinguish some small number of states. I don't think that was even a thing people thought about at the time. Certainly, Hayden Preskill did both an unentangled black hole and a maximally entangled black hole. You can do that for alphabets and everything in between, a partly entangled black hole. There's a simple formula. You just need to basically minus beta here, where beta is the fraction of the black hole that's entangled.
So more concretely, it's like I have some published result about this Hayden Preskill version, like a similar thing.
Okay.
I prepare a smaller message and then call it a message and then feed it into a random unitary.
Okay.
Then at the beginning, I thought that I need to collect how much poking radiation I need to collect. And the result was it's actually not that simple. So maybe we can just.
Okay, that would be definitely good to talk about.
Okay, so let's thank the speaker again.